so.
Well, we can open it up and you can field questions as you like.
Sure. One back, okay. Yeah, one back there, one here. Yeah.
The back.
Main question to the both speakers. First question. Statement on your slide was that addiction is not brain disease. If it's not, what is it? And this is first question for the first speaker. You remember this last day.
And put it there.
Before you, because you work in gender department. That means you said about genome. Statistic information about from genome, some. And of course, the same question. What does addiction, from your point of view, you said about genome using statistic, complex data, filtering data, we don't know how to do this, and where you have, for example, 56 gender, like your one, and one of these genders is, for example, if morning I, for example, feel like woman, but evening like man. How do you explain this five level above? Because genome is a molecular level, next is cell, tissue, organ, group of organisms, and psychological is five levels above. We have no any connection.
Okay, we're going to have to cut you off. Sorry.
No, this is my question.
No, it's a long question.
Do you want to say something about addiction?
Sure.
What it means?
My easy answer would be wait till I finish my book. But what I would say is it's very clear from the data that addiction really appears where you get people who are vulnerable to drugs abuse and use drugs in conjunction with patterns, social patterns. So it's really an anthropological problem. And what I would want to say is that, as I said at the end, we actually don't know. We don't know.
But we don't have a lot of...
So I'll stop there.
So as I usually say at the beginning,
I have a very easy answer, which is, c'est pas mon affaire. I don't work on either, you know, this is not a study about gender and 56 varieties, nor is it a study about addiction. It's a study about child neurodevelopment and diversity, and that's really all I'm reporting on. I remain extremely agnostic about where this technology is going. I think it's fascinating. I think they're smart. I think they're going to come up with lots. But whether they come up with anything that has clinical significance, I think is a very open question. And that's my professional stance. I mean, that's the level I always take in terms of all these new technologies. You know, I could be proven wrong, and I'm open to that. But I basically think what's going to come out of this are fabulous new technologies and platforms for science, far more than clinical intervention. So, but you had a question.
I was very interested in both of your talks. Mostly my question is, Mr. Reyna, you started in by saying, how do we diagnose learning disabilities? Can we see anything in the brain that will tell us we're dealing with a learning disability? As I thought on ahead, I apply the same criteria. How do we know, can we tell from the brain when learning has occurred? What can we look at, say?
Sure. I mean, that's...
No, I have a long question.
Oh, all right. A long question. Uh-oh. Go ahead.
Because I'll spell it out. we learn a new language. Can we give a class who has not learned the new language a brain scan, and then 6 months later, we test them with the same brain scan. Learning must have occurred. They know whatever the new language is. Chinese, preferably a non-Indo-European language for me. Now we look at the brain. Something must be changed in the brain.
Sure.
If we go back to according to Dan. Dan said, we can look at laboratory animals, let's say the white rat, but it won't tell us about language. There are things that laboratory animals can tell us, and there are lots of things that they can not tell us. The premise is quite clear. There must be a change in the brain if we have learned.
That is certainly, again, this is not the branch of neuroscience I'm working on, but there's a vast amount going on that brings educational tools and neuroscience together. And then some of the question is, how do you ask the questions? Because to go back to what Daniel said, you know, if you want to say some populations are inordinately vulnerable to addiction because of their social circumstances, do you also want to say that some populations are either inordinately open to good learning or to bad learning based on their social circumstances? And those are not questions that are inside the current studies as I understand them. So that's a problem.
Some populations learn more rapidly.
Right, but do you want to say it's in their brain, or do you want to say it's in the fact that, what is that statistic that's always quoted, that middle-class kids have heard 40,000 more words by the time they get to kindergarten? I'm making up the numbers, but it's approximately right. Or do you want to say, yeah, but let's talk about the meaning of those words and that middle-class environment and all the other things about it that prepare you for kindergarten? And what has that got to do with what's going on in your brain? So... I don't know if you wanted to.
Okay, I'm a little bit confused. If I understand you correctly, you're giving us an ethnography of all of this science that's going on, and they're taking parents off the hook for bad parenting by saying that it is in the brain, and there's a variability in brains of children, and you're getting a correlational study that's going on. Dan has already pointed out that brains are plastic. What is happening is, as children grow up, we embed in the brain certain things that come out of socialization and enculturation that leads to, at any point, studying these brains and getting this variability. But it goes back again to saying, is the science being conducted today leaving out the enculturation part of forming the plastic brain, or isn't it?
Short answer would be is yes, I think that they are leaving it out, although individual scientists may really get this argument. That is, if many people were here from that lab in this room, they would understand this conversation and want to participate in it. No, because that's, no, that's not the model. That's not where, what NIH is funding. That's not where any of this brain collaboration is going. Yeah, no, that's the problem. You got it. I mean, that's why I think it's worth doing an ethnography to try to understand what they are coming up with and what the next steps are going
to
be.
How do we get access to the technology that enables us to do what we think should be done?
That's, I think that's even better for you.
Okay, there's some questions.
Okay.
If you want to
yeah, you can ask me.
Okay. Or how's our timing? Maybe we should collect a couple of questions. Oh, okay, we have time. Okay, we could do one-on-one.
Okay, so the thing about the kid who was, like, you know, doing cocaine and, like, feeling very paranoid and lying. I was wondering if in your talks, if you... I'm very interested in how psychosis and psychosis-like states, and particularly paranoia, are expressed differently in different cultures, and I just wondering if there's anything you would like to say about that.
Yes, I mean, first I would point you to the work by Tanya Lerman, the Stanford anthropologist, who has a fascinating project looking at how these inner voices, that as a consistent feature of what we would call schizophrenia, vary across cultures and are not the aversive, damaging voices that we associate with sort of our Western model of schizophrenia. And it seems that's as much based on our Western model of self And so the symptomology and the consequence of that can be quite less, though can be debilitating as well, in other places that cultivate other forms of understanding what's going on. So that would be one line. The other line of evidence is very clear for people who move, for example, from the Caribbean to the UK. They don't change genetically, but the rates of schizophrenia go up. And it seems to do not just because with a shift in social experience, but exactly what I was trying to talk about. Social experience in conjunction with how their development is then changed, to go back to what you're talking about. So, but I would concur. Science is not built to be asked those sorts of questions in clinical or laboratory settings at present, even if they're quite interested.
Right to the back. There was one other question, I think, and then back then. Right to the back. Okay.
Several points. One, the reason there were no figures on youngsters with the characteristics that are now described is because the behavior was there, but no one was identified.
Right. You could be a James Dean rebel without a cause, or a dropout, or whatever. Right. Absolutely.
That's one point. The second point is, some of the things both of you were saying echoed in my ear with the sociology of science.
Right.
There were some very interesting similarities, and I wondered if you had explored some of those similarities. Because there's a huge literature on it, which I'm not sure is even being continued.
When you say sociology of science, do you mean the sort of the Merton period forward? Yeah. Right. Science studies has kind of merged the ethnography of labs with the sociology of labs in the last, whatever, 15 years or so. So, yes, I think there's a lot of circulation. Like, some of my early papers appear in a sociology of neuroscience book, where they're trying to figure out what the scientists are doing in the lab, too.
And my last question is, you were talking about an international group.
Yes.
And the question of translation, obviously.
Absolutely.
Very important factor. I mean, how do you translate some of the terms you were referring to in Dutch, German?
Right. You know, what they would probably say is that... to some extent, the mathematics are international, and the international language of laboratories, for better or for worse, right now is English. You know, 100 years ago it was German, now it's English. So they basically require people to be English-speaking. But in my lab notes, there are regular discussions in which I note down that there are 6 people in the room all speaking English, none of whom have it as a primary language. You know, so I totally agree with you. The question of what's easiest to translate, maybe the mathematics or the image or the abstraction, with a loss of exactly what Daniel is talking about, that is, that sense of the social embedding of the neurological, as you all pointed out. So I think that the very internationalism of the lab probably contributes to some of what we're talking about here.
Did you have one?
One little thing, kind of historical comment. I keep thinking of your speaking about it.
Yes, absolutely.
You're going in the same direction about getting it.
Well, or even worse than that, you know, the 19th century criminality and, you know, the physiotomy and what's in the craniology and the craniometry, all that stuff. The one thing I'd say, that's exactly where I started this study, was the assumption that this was a replication of some much older anxieties that were always sorting out people according to the various intersections of discrimination, and disability now was playing a major role there. But the one thing I would say that's popped up that's slightly different is, I want to say that some of the advocates now themselves use this language and these images and these techniques to do other things. And I think the jury's out. We'll see how successful they are, but I work with two, well, really one, I'm just going to talk about one, young adult group of college-age students. I might have mentioned them here at some other time. Their name is Eye to Eye. They used to be called Project Eye to Eye. It's the first national organization of young people who went through school with what's called an IEP, an individual education plan, which is a mark of special ed. It means you're it's the green card to get into special ed. It's both a huge stigma and a huge resource allocation. You can't get in without it. So once you have a diagnosis, you get this IEP. It's renewed every year. These are kids who grew up with IEPs and who now have made it to college, which is not all that common, let me tell you. So the college kids are the elite here. They mainly had diagnoses of ADHD. Some had learning disabilities or dyslexia. They turn around, they organize in middle schools near their colleges, and they run what they call a Beyond Normal art class, in which they use creativity and art forms to teach kids who have the same diagnoses they once had, that they're actually cool and they can use their differences and it's not a bad thing to be different. So they all have adopted this language of neuroplasticity and neurodiversity. They're using it for their own benefit and their own purposes. I'm not arguing that that overwhelms, you know, the other kinds of public tutorial work that's going on. I'm just saying it's complicated because to the extent that's in the public domain, people can own it and use it in very different ways than maybe was anticipated in some of the original scientific studies.
I have a question.
Okay.
I'm wondering if there are any studies that have been done, parallel studies that have been done at this point, all over, in order to see whether what we're getting in the internet, whether it's parallel or not, whether the differences, whether it's plastic or whether it's intestine. That, and the simple thing that you suggested before, for example, taking someone who doesn't know basketball in sports,
what kind of learning is going on? Yeah.
What I would say is, to answer your first question, is there's a rapidly growing field called cultural neuroscience, which does exactly that, does neuroimaging across different countries. You might call my whole presentation sort of a critique of culture neuroscience because it very much operates on this culture as a sort of superficial outside thing and genes as also the sort of the nature-nurture thing. Nonetheless, they are empirically tackling this all the time. You get really fascinating stuff where you can have bilingual individuals and you get them to switch the language they're thinking in and the brain lights up in different ways. You can get them to, so for example with Chinese students, if they're thinking about their mothers in Chinese, there's much more in the areas of the brain that we associate with self. It seems like mother's also getting activated with self. So there's this more sort of this idea from cultural psychology of this more interdependent self. You get them to start speaking in English and those things get separated out. So you do see these fascinating things, but a lot of the stuff that came up earlier about technical knowledge and the ability to do comparison are hotly debated in cultural neuroscience. And it's actually not just the techniques, sometimes it's the machines. There's all this sort of shop talk about, are you using the same machines? And they took one machine from the U.S. and all over China. Would the brain images end up being the same with the exact same experience? They did, but they don't look the same as other machines.
Thank you both. It was a fascinating discussion. My question is sort of bridging both of your talks, the idea of addiction and the idea of cognitive disorder. I've written to you before. My son is on the autistic spectrum, and some of what I find interesting is that, you know, one could say that there's a tendency to be addicted to certain things when a kid is on the autism spectrum, like screen addiction or ADHD, you know, this sort of hyper-focus that is different than when we talk about drugs, but there's obviously a parallel of this idea of wanting more and more, it's not rewarding. Well, I always think of that as reward-focused, but it's helpful with what you said, it's about sort of this, the brain wanting more and more of certain things when it comes to drugs, but I just wondered if there's the science of, you know, if and I've mentioned this to you before, rather than thinking about it in terms of a disease, and I think that studies of autism and other cognitive disorders, sometimes there's that disease discourse, but there's also an interesting way to think about it in terms of evolution, or what is the brain evolving towards if, you know, if in fact there is an uptick in diagnoses. It's not simply that it was underdiagnosed in the past, but maybe there's a shift, and is this related to studies of the addicted brain or sort of this hyper-focus, or I don't know, I wonder if there's this cross-fertilization of ideas about how the brain works, if it's evolving towards something or a different kind of brain.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, as I was very clear, I think it's a very needed conversation, and I think we both saw lots of parallels. I think one reason we need each other is one of the strengths but also weaknesses I have is I'm really interested in what the science can tell us to inform the sort of questions I have about human variation. That means I have to read a lot of science and figure out a lot of science. And that doesn't necessarily get at some really crucial questions about how this stuff plays out in a broader world. And so no one person can tackle these sorts of things. As she was talking about, I do think we need to have the lone wolf anthropologist as this sort of image for a long time. I think we need to think about how we can put together collaborative projects to tackle some of these things. And from my point of view, it has to happen, but anthropology needs to grow and show its relevance by doing some of that work, to show some of this, why it matters. And then we just need to grow the field. That's the long term.
Sure. I have two dumb questions. You were talking about color spectrums and numbers, and I was thinking of the romantic poets who had what they call synesthesia. So different emotions in probably, and associated with numbers. That's the first part. And the second part is jazz musicians have different sorts of brain connections with playing jazz, with their own rhythmic connections that they wouldn't have if they were speaking. So my overall question is there any research on creative activity, you know, poets and musicians and creativity in the brain that shows that, you know, some people in these fields have particularly electrifying regions of creativity compared to the rest of us sort.
So, well, what I would start to answer that question is saying they're doing the neuroimaging by it, but most of the neuroscience on that comes from the very model we're critiquing and doesn't necessarily look at sort of the set of practices that jazz musicians and the historical tradition of jazz musicians have put in place, the ability to do that. They assume that it has to be something that was innately there from the start, and there might be small variations, but we amplify them. And so the person I know closest coming to do that sort of work is, again, this European colleague, Andreas Roepstorff, who's looking at how people in laboratory settings can sort of culturally entrain each other. How do they come into that rhythmic match? But it's very clear, yeah, from neuroscience, they can't get into these machines, which I was talking about, two people and play, do a jam session.
That'd be great.
But in terms of the talent issue, that's such a big question right now. The latest thing I read on the talent issue is that the 10,000-hour theme doesn't account for the actual patterns of variation. And so some people do need 10,000, some people need a lot less. And so there might be people who just do light up differently, and I think that's something we need to deal with. Who knows? It's fun though. But oh, one thing I did want to say though, one of the things we were talking about genes earlier is, so there's all this work for talking about talent and all this emphasis on trying to find genes for athletic success, right? And we're going to try to do the same things with neuroscience and all this other thing. If you really want to do it, and this actually has to come back to why what we can do as anthropologists, if you want to know some of the fast runners, right, you can do a muscle biopsy, you can do all the genetics, or you can simply time them. And that's actually a much, 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 like a category of five better predictor of who's going to be successful. If you time them when they're young, and that simple measurement is actually much, much better than any of the genetics stuff. So it's already in action. It's already in action. So if we can figure out all these things that we already know implicitly we should be relying on, that actually will probably give us the way to sort of figure out how we're hacking the brain and doing these sorts of things. So I think anthropology is well positioned to do that sort of thing because sometimes the simplest things are the best measurements.
You had your question. Well, we're going to wrap it up tonight. Thank you, everybody, and thank you, Laura. Next month, our last talk is on April 21st. Is that right? For the summer session. We have Professor Sarah Croucher.
Well, I didn't start out going after big data. I just about you're in the lab, you go where they go, and it happens so fast, and I'm so phenomenal.